You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.
Welcome to today's Live Talk. I'm your host, Michelle Gasso. This week on the Corrections Connection, we're looking at how to prepare for healthcare emergencies. And joining us today to discuss this topic is David Thomas, professor and chairman of the Department of Surgery and the Division of Correctional Medicine at Nova Southeastern University in Florida. Before he joined the university full-time, he was assistant secretary for health services and director of health services for the Florida Department of Corrections, and has held a variety of other medical positions within the Florida DOC over the years. He is also an advisory board member for the HIV Education in Prison Project report, which is published by Brown University. In addition to his involvement in correctional medicine, Thomas has had a private practice specializing in ophthalmology and diseases of the eye, and was a member of the Florida House of Representatives for 10 years. He is also the author of two novels and several papers and articles. Welcome to today's Live Talk, Dr. Thomas.
Hi, Michelle. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, we're happy to have you today. We wanted to discuss healthcare emergencies with you today, and included in that, I assume, are infections and diseases that can spread. Can you talk a little bit about what is it about a correctional population that might make it more vulnerable to these types of diseases?
If you don't mind, let's divide this into two areas.
Okay.
Let's talk about first, just briefly, jails and the emergencies in jails. And do away with them briefly, because you kind of want, I have the impression we want to attack infectious diseases more aggressively. But certainly coming into a jail has to take all comers, and people coming down high on drugs and alcohol present with a tremendous number of emergencies, medical emergencies that have to be treated in a sophisticated fashion. Jails every year have to be very careful about diabetics and acute attack who have either had insulin and not eaten, or who have eaten and not taken their insulin and then either don't disclose that or for some other reason wind up in a problem. But in terms of the prison population, you're then filtering out some of those things from jail, and you're seeing a unique population in prisons. Prisoners are not well cared for outside of a correctional setting. For the inmates in Florida, we did a study at one time a few years ago, and of the 75,000 inmates that we had, fully 66% of them, almost two-thirds, had their first significant medical encounter. And if you define a significant medical encounter as a prescription that was filled and at least taken half of, or any surgical intervention, they had their first significant medical encounter in an incarcerated setting. Mm. So these people are not accessing health care when they're not in a correctional environment, either a jail or a prison. And then a lot of folks comment on how old and stressed out even young inmates appear. Prison is an extremely stressful environment for an inmate, and they do tend to age rapidly. Now, I cut you off. You were going to ask something else.
No, I was just going to comment that they're not a particularly healthy group of folks, and then so that just in and of itself might make them more susceptible to things.
Right, and added onto that poor protoplasm is the general, general susceptibility is the close quarters among inmates and their own antisocial behavior. Gastrointestinal outbreaks were frequently traced to food that was stolen and hidden in unrefrigerated or uncontrolled environment, and then later eaten, and the inmates would get sick with it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, they do their own, some of their own behaviors in a prison setting that can make them sick and can make others sick, I suppose, in that case, if they shared it.
Right, right.
Are there some other behaviors that inmates have that are kind of unhygienic and that can kind of lead to illness spreading? And
Yeah, medical care is one of the few things in life that an inmate can control. And he or she can't control where they live, where they go in their daily life. All of that's assigned, but they can control medical care. And so frequently they will not take best medical advice simply because they're mad at the officer that told them to come to medical, or they're upset with somebody in the ward or in the unit or something like that. And so for reasons, in fact, I had an 18-year-old diabetic boy that had to go into diabetic ketoacidosis and pass out before I would treat him, and I explained to him probably 50 times that you are setting yourself at risk for pulmonary and renal and ocular problems if you continue to do this. And indeed, he continued to do it because it was the only thing in his life he could control.
Huh. So you have to be kind of cognizant of that and their and the way that they react to information and authority and that sort of thing. One of the most contagious diseases that correctional facilities face is tuberculosis, and I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how prevalent it still is in corrections. Do agencies still have to be on the lookout for it, and have agencies, correctional agencies, gotten better at prevention and isolation?
Well, as I listen to that question, I have to comment as a physician and as a physician who has had some experience in correctional diseases. Tuberculosis is a significant problem in most prisons. However, it is not a wildly infectious disease.
Okay.
It is a moderately difficult disease to transmit. However, it is a problem because of the close proximity and the population in a correctional setting, and correctional systems, therefore, are very vulnerable to TB. Probably in the late 70s, we thought, without a vaccine, we were naive enough to think that we'd probably ridded the country of tuberculosis, except in South Miami Beach and a couple other isolated pockets, but that wasn't true, and correctional environments are even at greater risk because of duly infected TB HIV patients. As people have their immune status lowered, which happens with HIV, they become far more vulnerable to tuberculosis. The Florida system, when I was running that, the health services and that, we took TB very, very aggressively and seriously. For 2002, we only had a total of 12 cases, and all of those were admitted to us.
Oh, wow.
We had immediate isolation of any complex of symptoms that suggested TB. Anyone with a cough, fever, weight loss, night sweats, or any combination of that cluster, we felt that our index of suspicion was so high that it was better to isolate them than not isolate them.
So with any one of those symptoms, you guys pulled them out?
Not any one, but any two.
Okay.
Or fever, night sweats, or weight loss.
Mm-hmm.
We would pull them out. We'd run an x-ray. And our physicians became acutely aware of the fact that TB in an HIV-infected patient can certainly look like PCP. It doesn't necessarily have to have a typical apical view. It can have a middle or lower lobe cluster of appearances. And so we were very aggressive. We had put people on INH prophylactically every time, or if their PPD changed, if they couldn't document that they had been treated on the outside, we would treat them with INH as they came into our system.
Can I just ask you quickly what's INH?
I'm sorry. Isoniazid. It's
oh, okay.
One of the... it's probably the most used prophylaxis against tuberculosis
okay.
infection
okay.
That there is. We made it very, very easy to isolate somebody in a reverse isolation air exchange room. There are some systems, unfortunately, and sometimes this is union-driven, that treat isolation as a difficult or overbearing approach. Because of that, the physicians tend to use isolation infrequently. It probably ought to be used much more frequently, and those systems should try and relax the administrative component around isolation. All of the inmates, in terms of prevention, what we did that all of the inmates that came in received a two-step Mantoux PPD test, which is a test for tuberculosis infection, and any positives were put on a prophylactic regimen, which I mentioned was INH.
Does that happen at intake, or does that happen as a symptom?
It happened at intake,
okay.
And it happened every year.
Oh, okay.
And I said infection. I really should distinguish between tuberculosis exposure. Let's say your little two-year-old boy, if we tested him today, he would have a negative PPD. If he were exposed to someone with tuberculosis, that PPD would probably turn positive. That does not mean he is an ongoing infection with tuberculosis that's going to cause him a problem. And if we jumped on that situation immediately, and we used prophylaxis, we could keep him from developing a problem of TB.
So that's why it's so important.
So that's why it's so important to keep a high index of suspicion and prophylax right away. Now, when people get HIV, sometimes the prophylaxis is not as effective as it should be. And sometimes they simply, for one reason or another, aren't prophylaxed in some systems. And in some systems they fall through the cracks, or people come in with active, aggressive TB and spread it all the time that they should be in isolation. And so they wind up with multiple cases.
Now, is that because the symptoms don't appear the same when someone's also HIV positive?
Yes, yes. Or you explain away the symptoms with for other reasons. You get weight loss. You can get weight loss with HIV and HIV wasting syndrome, and changes in body habitus. And so you tend to find, if your index of suspicion for TB isn't high, you tend to find other very plausible reasons.
So you have to be aware that that's a possibility.
Right.
I wanted to move on to some other illnesses that could be easily spread. Wondering about those through food preparation. Is that something that corrections agencies ought to be cognizant of?
Corrections agencies and cruise ships.
Yes.
That was a joke because, you know, probably the whole country knew from television and radio and newspapers. But yeah, foodborne problems are significant and can be significant in a correctional setting, and the common route is the fecal-oral route, as the classic epidemiologic mode. We had outbreaks of, just like the cruise ships, we had outbreaks of Norwalk or Norwalk-like viruses. Food handlers and preparation services have to have cleanliness constantly reinforced. A study that was done, and I don't remember whether it was done recently or a while ago, But once again, to take a page from the cruise ships, the CDC evaluated in the single in spite of the Disney vote, the single largest factor associated with foodborne outbreaks on the cruise ships was the age of the ship.
Mm.
That age factor outweighed all other factors because apparently the organisms wind up not being cleaned away. And of course, the older the ship, the harder it is to clean, the more disproportionate the foodborne outbreaks are. The same is true of the prison. And most of the prisons in this country are older facilities.
Sure.
Cleanliness, proper refrigeration, other public health measures are essential.
Right.
One of the things agencies might consider is accreditation, because in the accrediting process, whether it's done by Joint Commission on Accreditation or the National Commission or the ACA's Health Care Accreditation, all of them check things like refrigerator settings and cleanliness and things like that. And we are trying to develop some prospective views of accreditation and foodborne outbreaks to see if they're lower in accredited facilities. You certainly get the feeling.
Sure. That would be an interesting set of data when it comes out. If you're just joining us, we're talking to David Thomas, professor and chairman of surgery and correctional medicine at Nova Southeastern University, about healthcare emergencies in the correctional setting. There was another topic I wanted to discuss today is there was a recent infection in Ohio prison related to a staff infection, and there's been some news reports about an inmate that had died from it. I was hoping you might be able to address how unusual or common it is for a staph infection to actually get so serious, and what can be done to prevent such a thing.
Well, I have to profess some ignorance in the Ohio situation. The only thing that I have to go by are the media reports, and having been the unwilling target or victim of a bunch of media reports, some of which were quite erroneous, all I can really do is talk generalities.
Okay.
Staph aureus is really a common bacteriologic organism. It's around us all the time. In the past few years, there has been a multi-drug resistant strain of Staph aureus, which we have designated MRSA,
okay.
Multi-drug resistant Staph aureus. That's how clever we are with acronyms. And that's primarily a hospital-based disease, although there is a community form. This is a disease that has to be taken seriously. People can slough whole layers of tissue throughout the body with this. It certainly, probably anything that pierces the skin can do this. So. Tattooing should be a factor on a correctional physician's mind, and think about it. Ordinary staph aureus is pretty easy to treat if caught early enough. Any of the common antibiotics can do it. If MSRA is effective against there are only three antibiotics really that are effective against MRSA. And the common one that we all use is vancomycin. And until the other two newer ones came out, and we don't have a tremendous amount of experience with them yet, in the Florida system, vancomycin could only be authorized for use by me as the director, or my associate director who back then was Dr. Hurwitz. That's the safeguard we put on vancomycin so that it would still be effective against MRSA.
So not used too frequently as to
not
cause the resistance
too frequently,
to that.
But if you do have a strain of multi-drug resistant Staph aureus, you've got to treat it effectively. You've got to treat it for a long time. You've got to make sure your patient is totally healed before you stop.
Interesting. So something that correctional facilities ought to keep in mind.
Yeah, it's going to be a problem because initially it was only a nosocomial infection, that is a hospital-based infection, and now we're seeing community strain of it as people with dialysis and things like that are, and it's eventually, if not already, going to be in the correctional system.
Right. Our last topic I want to address today is related to the possibility of terrorist acts in a correctional facility, and I'm thinking, as I say this, there are vaccinations going on for smallpox with some healthcare workers. There was also, obviously, a year or so ago, a lot of worry about anthrax. Are those things that correctional healthcare officials need to think about, prepare for? Are there any suggestions that, you know, folks are talking about in the field that you might want to pass on?
Sure. Shortly after the anthrax scare in our system, quite a few of us received envelopes from inmates that had a white powder in them.
Huh.
They uniformly turned out to be talcum powder, but it did wind up causing the closure of the mail facility and decontamination efforts and things like that. Any prison could be, I would not think that a prison would be a high terrorist target for things like that, but it certainly could be an incidental target. And so I think it's incumbent on all prison health care providers to be aware of that possibility and follow the guidelines of their health department and the Homeland Security Department.
Mm-hmm.
If you are going to do smallpox in your system, you ought to check the HEP news of a couple months ago. Dr. Joe Bick in California did an outstanding review of some of the precautions to take. The smallpox vaccination is an attenuated virus of cowpox, and it is transmissible.
Mm-hmm.
And in people with compromised immune system, let's say I am working in a correctional facility as a physician and I get a smallpox vaccination. Were I to rub up against an open wound on an inmate with HIV and a poor immune system, I would be unnecessarily exposing that inmate. And so there are devices that could be used to cover the area of smallpox. In fact, the area of the immunization until you're no longer infective.
I see.
And that probably should be done. And like I said, there is an excellent review by Dr. Bick in the HEP News.
Great. Thank you. That concludes today's live talk. Thank you to Dr. David Thomas, Professor and Chairman of the Department of Surgery and Department of Correctional Medicine at Nova Southeastern University in Florida, for joining us today. We're very happy to have you. And thank you all also to our audience for tuning in. For more information on responding to healthcare emergencies and corrections, be sure to read this week's articles on corrections.com. For CCNM, I'm Michelle Gasso.
You are listening to the Corrections Connection News Network, CCNN, your weekly news source for the corrections and criminal justice industry.